around the time of Galileo and those scientists starting to be clever and starting to ask questions, and they were even probably burned at the stake for daring to question the prevalent view of the universe, which was that it's religion. That was the prevalent philosophy, psychology, method for the universe, wasn't it? It was called religion in our world. So then slowly these scientists began to ask questions, and, you know, Galileo started to be revolutionary and dare to question the view that the church held, that the earth in fact moved around the sun, not the other way around, which is what evident to the mind, isn't it? So we all know this. So over the centuries we can see, can't we, that what we call science, which we call rational intelligence, that seems to be directly to do with the... Sounds like a rat. What was it? Oh, I see. How kind. Had it turned on. That's right, yeah. So we can see, isn't it, over the centuries, what we call rational, intelligent, mental, scientific, provable, suddenly developed into this extraordinary system which we have now, which is here, which, you know, you put your serious hat on if you go to a psychology class, don't you? You put your serious hat on if you go to a science class, right? But you put your weird, wacko belief system hat on if you go to a religious class. This is how our world is now, isn't it? So what's interesting about Buddhism, it's both aspects, you know? If you on the face of it, I mean, okay, I remember a friend of mine who's a scholar, studied Buddhist philosophy in depth, translates. Betsy Napper, she's an American woman, she's a scholar, a Buddhist scholar, okay? I mean, she studied in depth all the Buddhist philosophy and psychology and so on, highly intellectual. It's an intensely intellectual, you know, system of the universe, Buddhist philosophy and psychology. So she'd studied all this, and she was in Tibet one time. I was there too. And then, you know, you go around Tibet, and it's like this magical mystery land where statues grow and talk, and you have all these things, like they call them self-emanations, these images of Buddhas on the side of mountains that grow out of the mountain, which they then paint. So all of this, I mean, I'm talking about it here, but this fits perfectly with the Buddhist view that, you know, these things can happen. There's explanations of all this stuff. But for us, it's called a magical mystery, you know? It's like insane. Like, it's completely religion, which means not rational, which means not provable, which means mysterious. You get my point? So then, you know, and then there's Betsy, this scholar. And so this American tourist asked her, what does she like about Buddhism? Well, she said, you know, I love the intellect and the scholarliness and the philosophical approach and how you have to prove it to be true. Well, this woman was gobsmacked, because all she saw was religion and superstition and things coming out of mountains and statues growing taller and walking and talking. You hear my point? So the Buddhist view, like we've been talking constantly, I say this, it's actually Buddha's presentation from his own findings about the way the universe exists. So I mean, it's a presentation, it's actually a science in the way we use the word, literally. But we don't think it's like that because it's dealing with stuff that the physical scientific world says can't be true because you can't see it with your naked eye or with a microscope, you know? So what I'm saying is there are all these religious aspects. But what's so crucial to understand, which is what I find so appealing and what I continue to try to impress, is, as Tsongkhapa says in one of his texts, everything is to be taken as sound advice. Because there is no contradiction between scripture and practice. So that's like saying everything in a cookbook is to be taken as sound advice, because there's no contradiction between a recipe and a cake. That's completely reasonable, isn't it? We understand that, but we hear the other one, come on, who are you trying to kid? You know? Do you get my point here? So we've got to take that on board first. So you know, you've got to open your mind to the possibility, in other words, that phenomena that the usual scientific view says you can't prove is based on a series of conceptions that the mind is the brain and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Buddha's got a different series of assumptions. And then Buddha's view is, because he's a regular guy who came to see these things, he's either a completely insane wacko who made up lots of hilarious things, and it's possible, but you have to find out. You have to be confident. You have to find out if he's true or not, like any proper scientist would. That's the point. So therefore, we can see in Tibetan Buddhism, especially Tibetan Buddhism, You've got all these practices that look religious and do bear the label religious, but let's analyze what that means. So if it's true that every instruction is to be taken as sound advice because there's no contradiction between scripture and practice, and scripture just means a term they use for the words in the books, that, and if Buddhism is psychological, if the central player in our universe is the mind, and that's Buddha's expertise, which I've been saying often enough, and as far as I can see is true, then that means every practice in Buddhism has to help your mind. If it doesn't, it is just superstition. If a piece of advice in a recipe book just is uninteresting information but doesn't help you get a cake, you're going to get your money back. So if there is an instruction in Buddhism that doesn't help you work on your mind, doesn't enhance your ability to lessen delusions and grow virtue, bottom line, then it's a load of nonsense. It's a superstitious load of rubbish. It's a ritual and it is meaningless, and you chuck it out and give it right back to Buddha. From the stick is rituals. No, I'm serious here. Can you hear me? We've got to be rigorous in this way of thinking. We're kind of lazy a bit and kind of float along and like belief systems, and I believe in that until you don't like it anymore. Then you believe in something else. So therefore, okay, she just mentioned prostration. That's a Buddhist practice. So on the face of it, you walk in, you see these Tibetans, you see movies and things, and these Tibetans flopping down, chucking their entire body on the ground, getting up again, you know? And they do it again, and they do it again. They even do it for hours and days, and they do it for millions of kilometers, you know? Well, not millions, thousands. If you were in the Kamachakra initiation in D.C. a few years ago, you'd see Tibetans circling the block, prostrating their way around the block to the amusement of the local Americans, you know? You hear about people, you know, prostrating across Tibet to Lhasa, taking them 2 years. Then you look at things, and you look on this altar, and you see a Buddha looking holy. Then you'll see offerings on the altar. All these things are to what we call religious, which we assume are just belief system, just rituals, you know. We see people make mandala offerings. Seems like a ritual. We say this. People have the biggest problem. I don't like the rituals, they say. The commonest thing we say is we don't like the rituals. Are we communicating here? Right. So we have to analyze how a thing that we label a ritual can help your mind. Again, if it doesn't, don't do it, please. Use your common sense. So what's an offering? Well, on the altar, you're going to see, they've got this tradition, you've got these bowls, water bowls, you know, and it's referred to as the eight sense offerings. And it's based on an Indian tradition of when you have a guest, you first offer them water to drink, and then you wash their feet, offer water for washing, and then you offer them flowers, you put the garland around their neck, then they must come in the house and you offer incense by now, and then you put the lights on because it's getting dark probably, and now you offer them perfume, it's getting sexy by the minute, and then you offer them dinner, and then finally you bring out the dancing girls, and now you offer them music. I'm just making up a bit of a story here. But there's this tradition of these offerings, and you make them to the Buddha. So then you have to ask your question, what do you mean make them to the Buddha? What the hell does a Buddha want an offering for? On the face of it, it's a perfectly reasonable question, especially a statue. Was a statue with an offering, God Almighty. So let's analyze it psychologically. Because the emphasis here is on what's going on in the mind. Remember the point in Buddhism that every millisecond of every thought you have sows a seed in your mind and molds that mind of yours into that shape. So if we know in the world there's a poor person, and you give them, like, there's Natasha, she's poor, and I give her 20 quid. Well, we all understand that because there's a person there who needs 20 pounds, and you give the 20 pounds, isn't it? But then we accept, we understand. But our point mainly here is we think it benefits Natasha, and that's it. We don't tend to think that makes any difference to me. We wouldn't call that my practice. But the Buddha would say, in fact, that's an amazing practice, a practice of generosity. It's kind of obvious what the practice of generosity would do for me. So clearly when I'm miserly and mean and don't want to give, whom am I harming? Me. It's sort of, forget whether there's Natasha there, me wanting to change my meanness and wanting to put my hand in my pocket and give some of my money to someone else, obviously is a really good practice for me. It benefits me. We're not just thinking this way. We only think of it as a practice if you sort of sit there and watch your breath or something, you know, or look at your mind. But generosity is an obvious, excellent practice to do. For me, the bonus is she gets 20 pounds. So then you can think of the Buddha. Well, how is that going to benefit? Well, clearly, Mr. Buddha, you know, the statue represents the person who lived 2,500 years ago. So why do you even need a statue? Well, you know, why do you need a picture of your beloveds? Because it reminds you of them. It makes you happy. It gives you pleasure. You put the pictures in nice frames on your mantelpiece or something, and it gives you pleasure to remember them. Why do you have if you're a tennis player, why would you have a poster of Serena on your wall? Because she shows you what you can become. It's got a practical benefit, you know? So why do I have a statue of Buddha? Because it reminds me of what I want to become, because we're beings of form and shape. So it enhances it reminds me of what I want to become. Does it make sense? It's kind of reasonable. So it's a benefit to me. So then my making offerings, you know, in my heart, me wishing to offer to the Buddha, that would be a pretty stupendous practice, I'd suggest. I'm the beneficiary there. It's a practice for me. Don't underestimate this. It's a practice for me. And what am I doing? Lessening meanness, lessening, you know, attachment, lessening things. So then, does that make sense? It's a perfect, reasonably good thing to do that'll help me psychologically. So then let's look at a prostration. Yes, it's a ritual. But so what? So is a handshake. You know, you put your hand out to a Tibetan. Oh, hello. They look like who doesn't know Western habits, you know? Who's never seen a Western habit. They go, I remember some of the lamas you meet, or the geshis. And they're new ones, so they don't speak English, haven't been around Westerners. You put your hand out. Okay. You stick your hand out. Come on, shake hands. Then they kind of take your hand, and they're sort of all wimpy, because they don't know what a shake hand is. Why not? Because it's a Western culture. It's not existing from its own side. It is a ritual. But because we all do it, we're used to it, we buy into it, and then we think it's true, isn't it? Well, everything we do is a ritual. Going to the toilet, picking up your clothes, putting your bum on the thing with a hole there, pull the chain, you know. It's a ritual. It's how we do it. Like in India, they pee on the side of the road. We think that's rude. You know, for us, to pick your ears in public is considered a rude ritual to do. But among the Tibetans, I've been into the teachings of the Dalai Lama, you know, the worst thing you can do among Tibetans with the Dalai Lama's teachings is stick your legs out. That's like considered the rudest behavior, like being naked or something. But so there's this monk in front of me at His Holiness's teachings with his quick Q-tip, what do you call it? What's that thing called? That one. He's going... in the other ear, you know? But his legs are crossed. He's okay. So it's all rituals. It's a question of what you accept and what you know, it all means something. Does it all mean something? But remember how we created everything. Our mind creates all of it. But it's sort of like we're like children, one lama said. We're like children who draw a lion and then become afraid of it. Do you hear that? Everything the Buddha says is made by the mind. Everything is psychological. So our trouble is we forget it, so we shake hands and we think it exists from its own side. We think a cup exists from its own side. We think there's an eye that exists from its own side. We think a ritual exists from its own side. No, it doesn't. It's something made up by our mind and we buy into the meaning. Therefore, everything we do with our body and speech and mind plays a role in what we do. So when you start being a Buddhist, you don't, you know, like when I was a Catholic, I would genuflect, wouldn't I? And I'd do a single genuflection, but on Holy Fridays what's the round one with the big shiny bits shouting out? And our Lord is open, the door's open. What's it called? Thank you. The what? The sack is open, you know? So you do double genuflections, don't you? Of course it's ritual, but it has meaning. I was a really holy Catholic. I loved going to, you know, benediction on Fridays when they opened up the sacrament, our God, our Lord was there. I loved going to communion, our Lord's body. I loved it. I wanted to be an altar boy. I wanted to be the priest, actually. Forget the altar boy. It's all rituals. But everything we do with our body and speech, because we are embodied people, has meaning. We should make it have meaning. Are you seeing what I'm saying, people? So, a prostration. What is it? Well, I'll tell you. I met Lama Yeshe for the first time. You know, I didn't know. When I met him, I went to these teachings, and I really liked him, and went to these 2 months of teachings at Chenrezig Institute in Australia. And, you know, I sort of sensed I found my path, blah, 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 whatever. Studied really hard, did a retreat, went back to Melbourne and started practicing, and then discovered in my mind that, you know, I figured Lama Yeshe was my teacher, you know, whatever, guru, whatever. So the next year I went back and I kind of demanded a meeting, and I informed him he was my lama. I didn't know you're supposed to ask. You're supposed to sort of request and make offering. I didn't know any of that, being arrogant. So I said, you are my guru. Well, I didn't use those words. I was too proud. But he knew what I meant. He said, yes, I know, dear. Anyway, the point is, the thing is, I forget, lost the plot again. What was I saying? I'm so sorry, I'm really terrible. Oh, thank you, thank you. Yeah, so, you know, I asked him for a practice. So he gave me prostrations to do. There's this particular practice, you know, you stick your body on the ground, say certain names of Buddhas. And then he tried to soften my pride. He said, it's good physical yoga, dear, you know, like that. So I immediately started doing prostrations. Well, all I know is I didn't have a clue what I was saying. I was saying these Tibetan words, but I knew something inside was cracking open, you know. I was happy to do it. I didn't know what it meant much, but I was happy to do it. And then, you know, and then since then, Lama Zopas told me it's the practice I should do morning and night till the day I die. So I'm stuck with it, right? So I can really see it brings, but so what's the meaning of it? Well, it's, you know, the Buddha's view of karma is obviously, as I'm talking, as we talked yesterday, whatever we do with our body and speech, not to mention the mind, is part of what programs our mind. We're programming ourselves every minute. We're molding our mind into who we become. We are the creators of ourself. So me buying into, that's all you're doing. I'm buying into it. Someone says do kung fu. I buy into kung fu. I do what my teacher says. You know, it's a ritual, but I do it because I want to do it. So I buy into it. So I come to the Buddhism and I buy into what Lama Yeshe says because I've decided I'm going to do it. I've decided. No one's forcing me. I've decided. So I mightn't understand a prostration straight away, but I decided. I trust Lama. I'll do what he says, like my kung fu teacher. You know, I'll just do what Mr. Lee says. So I did what Lama said. I did prostrations. So then I understood that you say certain names and it's said to be to do with softening pride. Well, I tell you, it's true. It's obvious. You put your whole body on the ground, get up again. It's hard work. So there's something about it. You can see the meaning is kind of there, you know. But you're buying into doing it. Not doing it because you're fearful and someone says you should, because you decided you want to. And you're buying into the meaning of it. That's interdependence. That's emptiness. Like, so then you look at all these pictures, these weird, strange, you know, ladies and gentlemen naked with many arms and legs and God knows what else. You understand? What does that mean, we'll say? Well, that's psychology as well. That's called Chenrezig, this one here with 1,000 arms. It's called the Buddha of Compassion. It's Indian culture. The Tibetans took it on. So you don't know by looking at it, it means compassion. Well, when you hear the word compassion for the first time and you've never heard the meaning, you don't know what it means either. But you buy into the meaning when mummy tells you what it means. That's how we learn everything. So you decide you're going to buy into it being compassion. So then when I visualize it, we're going to do that now, this meditation, you visualize the Buddha, I'm buying into that's Chenrezig. I visualize it with 1,000 arms to help 1,000 sentient beings. So what does that energize in my mind? But compassion. If I sit there every day going, hate, 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 I hate you, I hate you, guess what kind of person I'm becoming? Hardly rocket science, is it not? If I praise guns every day and put guns on my wall and love guns and pull guns and push guns and buy guns and save guns, don't be surprised you pick a gun up one day and shoot somebody. It's hardly rocket science. So, okay, now, next point. The actual job of being a Buddhist is being your own therapist. It's the best way to put it. It's that, in other words, when you enter high school, like in the structure we've been talking, where you begin to learn the technique of concentration, meditation, which came from the Hindus, these amazing Hindus, then you learn the Buddhist model of the mind, and then you start to apply that in your daily life and start to change your mind. That's actually the job of being a Buddhist. So, you know, there's this nice story about one famous holy person called Atisha, and somebody came up to him and said, oh, I did my prostrations. And Atisha said, that's very nice. I'd like you to practice a spiritual path. Then he said, all right, I'll do something else. Oh, I just did my mandala offerings. I'm very happy. I'd like you to practice a spiritual path. Oh, dear me, I better think. Well, I did my mantras. Oh, I'm very happy. I'd like you to practice a spiritual path. In other words, doing mantras in themselves isn't spiritual practice, isn't working on your mind. The actual job is to change your mind from delusion to virtue. That's the essential job. Doing your prostrations isn't actually doing that. You know, being holy and being a nun isn't actually doing that. So, like, if you go to, I always use this example, when I was in America, you go to basketball and you see them all get the ball in the hoop, isn't it? And you get the idea that the many balls in the hoop, and that there's the winner, isn't it? So the point of basketball, finally, all the la-di-da, all the nonsense, all the stuff, all the things, is to get the ball in the hoop. Would you agree? So then you go to Michael Jordan, hey, man, oh, it looks so fantastic. Can you show me how to get the ball in the hoop, please? And he says, yes, Rabina. Well, first of all, lose 50 years, if not more. go back and then do a couple of years of this and get fit and put the muscle tone and study the body and the dynamics of this and the basketballs and then go to college and study for 2 years of philosophy or something, blah, blah, blah. And no, Michael, you didn't hear me. How do I get the ball in the hoop? And he'll repeat his answer, won't he? Because it looks phenomenally easy just to get the ball in the hoop. But we all know the easier something looks is the more practiced it is. Like you're saying, may I play the piano like you, Mr. Mozart? Yeah, 30 years of practice and you might. So we all know that if the essence of being a Buddhist is working on your mind, it sounds easy. We can hear the words. But it is the hardest job we'll ever do, especially the way we talk about it using Buddha's view. Unbelievably difficult job. Everything in us wants to go against it. Unbelievably hard to identify the delusions from the virtues. It's a phenomenally advanced job to do. So basically, in the Tibetan tradition, what they'll say is, well, if you go off and do your 3 years of prostration, your 2 years of this, and your one of this, and your mandala offerings, and create generosity, and you do your thing, and you put on pride, and you live in vows, that'll soften your delusions. That'll enable you. That'll prime your mind so that then you start to look at your mind falling off a log. Easy. So it's the going off and doing all your study and your prostrations, I mean all your, you know, push-ups and everything. Are you hearing what I'm saying? That's the function of what looks like religious practices. You don't believe it, you buy into it, that's what it means. You buy into it. Making offerings, doing this, it's said to be hugely, it primes your mind. Mightn't be evident to us, so one has to look into it carefully and think about it, you know. So the direct answer to your question is how you work on your mind. If you recognize that pride, you know, is this fragile kind of bit sort of sensitive sense of self that needs to be kind of looked after and nurtured. And so when you notice it, well, then the simplest, the most direct way to counteract something is to do the opposite, isn't it? If you're playing the piano and you're playing the wrong note, you don't have to go to a therapist and wind up work on to do. You just play the right note. Don't you? If you're driving on the road and you're kind of merging into the wrong lane, I'd suggest you get quickly into the right lane. Instead of just, we often have a tendency of saying, well, you've got to watch your mind, just watch the mind. Oh, well, I'm watching myself merge into the wrong lane here. Excuse me, I don't care. Get the hell back in the right lane. I've observed myself play the wrong note. It's a bit sort of nihilistic, the mistaken way we think about observing your mind. The only reason to be mindful, the only reason to observe your mind is to see what the hell is there and recognize which delusion is running rampant and argue with it. Bring out the virtue to argue. So what's the opposite of you notice I'm feeling a bit fragile here, a bit sensitive, no one loves me. It's all right, Rabina, it's okay, darling. It doesn't matter that other people love you. It's not the point. You learn to be kind to yourself. You learn to recognize that you're good enough as you are. Whatever argument you like to argue with the story, but you have to hear the story. And that's what's hard because they're so instinctive. And we often don't notice until the punch comes or the drama happens, you know. So the simplest level of daily practice is the more you hear, you feel, we feel them first, it's harder, then we begin to see the story that underpins the feeling. Do you see? And you argue with it. You bring out your good roommate and you argue with it to yourself like you'd be your own therapist, quite literally. Do you see? This is profound daily practice. Does that make sense? I don't believe you've never done it. You do. You're a Buddhist from years. Come on, you're underestimating yourself. How long have you been a Buddhist? Years, isn't it? Sweetheart, precious one. That's right. So you mean you've never worked on your mind until now? I don't believe you. Well, then what do you mean then? In what way have you worked on your mind? Not in the way I'm talking? You mean you never debate? I know you are, but you're like the rest of us. It's really all right, darling. I know she's getting a bit, I'm being a bit direct. It's all right. But are you seeing every single day you're working on your mind, surely? Talking to yourself, trying to be virtuous, well, sweetie pie, you know what I'm saying. Give yourself a break. You're doing better than you think. And how marvelous that you're seeing from this discussion those things in yourself. I mean, we've got to first see them. We've almost got to be so happy that we see the rubbish. A sister of mine went to the doctor just to have a checkup, and they happened to find a little growth, which was a malignant melanoma. She would have died of cancer in a month. So she was shocked to find a cancer, but wasn't she happy to find it? Because now she could fix it. So this is the miracle. They say the very first sign of success when you start to do these meditation techniques is that you think you're getting worse. But we're not. So we're so blissful that we see our mind because now we know what to fix. Now we know what to argue with. And that's what takes courage, isn't it? Because we don't like to see it, you know. We feel bad, you know. Isn't it? So yes, indeed, nevertheless, as you're a practitioner and you have these other practices, these other ones, I can say from my experience, are phenomenal to help you prime your mind, to see your mind better and better every day. That's the benefit. You know, directly, it doesn't look like when you're doing your push-ups, that'll help you get the ball in the hoop better. But it does, because it makes you fit and more flexible. So same with these practices, they make your mind more flexible. Do you understand? So any practice you know about that you've heard from your teachers, yeah, you do those, absolutely, darling. Are we communicating? Are we communicating? We are communicating. Someone else, before we do the practice. Yes, yes. Microphone, please.
Regarding the rituals, there are some things that still don't make sense in my mind.
Many things. Sure.
You said that the definition of a negative karma is an action that hurts someone else.
The definition of a negative action is one that harms another. Bare bones. Yeah.
So about stepping on texts. On Dharma texts.
Oh, I see.
Leaving them on the floor, or being careless when you are setting up the water offerings.
I understand, yes, exactly.
Kind of knocking the bowls or something like that.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah. The lamb rim sets it like really bad.
I understand.
It's
that.
Really bad.
Exactly, I understand. So let's analyze it psychologically, shall we? Okay. So, if you have a person who's a very dear friend, a beloved, right? And you have a framed picture of them on your mantelpiece, right? And a person comes along and puts it on the ground and doesn't notice and just sits on it or stands on it or they chuck it in a drawer. How would you feel? Speak in the mic.
Probably bad.
You'd be insulted and offended, yeah. Would you not?
Yeah.
Because why? Because that person's precious to you. So, you know, so then if you do that, so let's say you've got your beloved there, and then you start to not care about them, and you put the thing in the drawer, and I'm your beloved, and I come home, and I say, where's my picture? Oh, it's in the drawer. Do you not think that's indicating that you don't care about me anymore? Wouldn't that indicate that? Wouldn't it indicate that I'm not so important to you anymore as you chucked my picture in the drawer with other things on top of it? Where's that picture of me, darling? Oh, I don't know. It's in the drawer somewhere. Wouldn't you think that indicates in your mind that you don't care so much about me? Would that indicate that?
Yes.
There you go. There's your answer. There's your answer. So you see, you don't hear it as a sin. You're hearing it as naughty. Because when you read the Tibetans, they like sound more fundamentalist than most. And I know that, but that's why you've got to use your intelligence, think through, and use your own words to comprehend it. Don't just hear their fundamentalist language. So anything we do leaves an impression in our mind. So if you have a beloved, a person you respect, and then you start to not respect them because you forget about them, so you stick them in the drawer, that indicates that you don't care about them anymore. That's just natural. It's completely natural. So that causes an obstacle between you and them. You'll see them again, you go, well, who's that person? Huh? You won't remember. It's natural. It's psychological. So if you have decided to like Buddha, to revere Buddha as your mentor, whom you're going to use as your reference point to show you how you can become like Serena on your wall, I'd be very offended if you just started, you know, rolling up my poster of Serena when she's my best person. So then if you want to like the Buddha and want to revere use his teachings to help you become a Buddha, then it would make sense you don't stand on it, sit on it, put it on the floor, chuck it in the bin, put other things on top of it, because whatever you put out there is the thing that's important to you. So it's a natural thing. Don't hear it in the way you're thinking. That means like naughty person. Oh, I'm a sinner. Wicked, wicked. Are you hearing me a bit better now?
Yes, yeah, I don't think I did, but I tried to find the reason.
What?
I tried to find the reason, not like the moralistic, you know.
But I've just given a reason. You didn't hear it.
Yeah.
But you didn't hear it.
Yeah, I did.
So But this is the meaning. You heard it as moralistic. You informed, your understanding of that is informed by your moralistic, dualistic view of punishment, reward, good, mm-hmm. bad, sin, and all the rest. That's how the Tibetans talk. But if Buddha's teachings are like what I'm saying, then it's not, no one's out there punishing you. See, just the same thing. If you go to the doctor and she says, what's your name again?
Abelardo. Abelardo.
Who? What's he saying?
Abelardo.
Spell it.
A-B-E-L-A-R-D-O. That's the label anyway.
No,
I have nothing to do with it.
No, no, shush. I want to get your label right. Ale what? Alibadro.
Abelardo.
Alibadro. Thank you. Alibadro. That's right? Not. Spell it again. Alibadro, without the R. Alibadro. Alibadro. Abelardo. Okay. Okay, Abelardo. Listen, Abelardo. Okay. I forget again what I was going to say. Okay, you go to the doctor, Abelardo, and she will say, oh my God, Abelardo, your lungs are in a complete mess. If you don't be careful, you're going to get lung cancer and die a hideous death. Would you hear that as moralistic? Would you say to that doctor, who do you think you are talking to me like that? You wouldn't say that, would you? Why? Talking through the microphone. Okay, go on. It's because she has the knowledge and that you're in big trouble, and if you don't stop smoking, you're going to die of cancer. So Buddha says, if you do this, you'll go to the hell realms. But we get a panic attack when we hear that because we think God's sending us there. Because we hear morality like that. We hear it as someone imposing upon you an instruction, and they're going to punish you if you don't do it. But we don't hear doctors like that. Well, the Buddha's exactly the same. But we've got to learn to hear it this way. And it's quite hard in these medieval Tibetan teachings. I know that. So we've got to grow up ourselves. That's why I felt from the very beginning when I heard all these teachings, I knew that it's up to us at this time in this world, who are Western, talking like we talk, to reframe these things, which is what I try so hard to do. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay. So are we now communicating a little bit better? Good. So now we can do this practice. Shall we do it? We'll finish with me leading you through these four steps of purification, which we talked about yesterday. The four opponent powers, it's called. Remember I said yesterday, it's like all of Buddhism, it's a psychological process. The first step is to regret the things we've done with our body and speech to harm others because, I'm just giving prelude here, then we'll go into it, because we don't want the future results, because I'm sick of suffering. This is the crucial first step. It's the recognition that what I do, say, and think will leave impressions in my mind and ripen as my experiences, and hey, I don't want suffering, which is like compassion for yourself. Then we think, whom can I turn to? Well, Mr. Buddha is our doctor, whom we rely upon, and then we have compassion for those who've harmed us, and compassion for those who we are. Well, the other way around, too. Then we go to the third step where we visualize and do this particular practice, which is this particular way of using your mind to visualize the Buddha, to visualize nectar coming, to visualize purifying, and the recitation of a mantra as the antidote, as they call it. And the fourth step is the resolve, as they call it, which is this determination to change. This is the psychological process of karma. There's no karmic imprint. There's no tendency. There's no thing that I can't change. And this practice, as Lama Zopa says, we're insane not to do it every day because it's you changing your mind. So be just very natural when we do it. Okay, I'll just lead you through. And whatever makes sense to you, you think my thoughts. Hear my thoughts. If you don't like them, you don't think them. You're the boss here, okay? So just relax. Okay, just check your body first. There's a classical way that's said to be really excellent to sit that's conducive for your mind to meditate properly. So the classic one, I'll go through them, okay? The classic position is what they call full lotus. And there's been something that's been found by all the great meditators to be really perfect, for the legs to be up in a certain position, the right thigh on the left, the back super straight. It's said to be really helps align the subtler energies. And in fact, I've heard the Dalai Lama say that until we can do this, we really can't do the highest practices. So he says it's really marvelous to start your practice with even for a second getting into that position, if we can. You know, so some of us aren't on the floor here, most of us aren't. But think this, you know. So if you can put one instep on the other thigh, that's great. If not, regular cross-legged, that's fine. If not, sit in a chair, do what you can, you know. So the first one is the legs. There's about 7 points, main points. The next one is your bottom. So ideally, the legs, when they're crossed, and unless you've done this all your life, your legs won't be this flexible, should be really flat when your knees are flat on the ground, you know. And then your underneath your coccyx, there should be a cushion that just props you up a little bit, which keeps you very stable. When you're sitting full lotus and with this cushion underneath you and your legs very flat on the ground, you're very stable. And this is a practical thing. Many of the great meditators can sit like this for days and weeks without toppling over, you know? But we have to find what works for us in terms of the cushion and how, and all these things. The next one is really crucial. It's your back. It should be really straight. They talk about the spine being like an arrow, ramrod straight. And the coccyx is the head of the arrow that points directly into the earth. Then they say that your shoulders should be very square, not slumped. So this for me helps me think, putting it this way, they don't say this, but this is my way of saying it. If you think of all your bones, your skeleton, and it's hanging on a hanger, it'd be ramrod straight, wouldn't it? Everything's completely straight, which is how your body should be. But our problem is as soon as we put our body upright, we tense the muscles. Then as soon as we flop the muscles, we flop our skeleton. So you've got to be totally straight. It's really important. But the muscles completely relaxed. So imagine your skeleton hanging on a hanger, then all the flesh and the soft bits hanging very loosely on the skeleton, which is upright. So up, put your body up, but now relax your muscles, especially your abdomen. We're so used to not wanting to look fat. We keep it tense all the time. Flop your muscles, flop your shoulders, but keep your bones upright, okay? It's a really good combination. Relax, but upright. So it's your legs, your bottom, your shoulders, your spine. Then you've got your hands. So now I'll show you the classical position that we learn in our tradition, but there's many ways you can do. And this is the left underneath, like this, and the right touching, the right on top. Thumbs touching, like that. That's the traditional position. It's called the meditation mudra, or gesture. But, you know, people put their hands on their laps, you do all kinds of things. So do whatever feels comfy for you. That's okay. But don't be tense. Have your arms away from the side of your body. And if you're on the chair, of course, you have your feet firmly planted in the ground. And I forgot this. You don't lean against the chair. Sit up straight, please. Don't slump. You've got to hold your own body up. That's really important. I forgot. So if you're in the chair, feet on the ground firmly and your body upright. And don't slump into the back. Don't hold yourself up. Don't have the chair hold you. You hold yourself up. That's important. Then the head is the final bit and there's several bits there. First of all, your lips slightly apart and the tip of your tongue resting behind the top teeth, just near the palate. It's kind of odd initially, but it's got practical meaning. It means if you meditate a lot, you won't dribble all the time. You won't have to swallow your spit so much, apparently. Then your head slightly tilted forward. Don't have your head thrust back. It makes the mind more agitated. Your head slightly tilted forward. Your chin a bit tucked in. And now your eyes. Most of great meditators who do meditation day and night or, you know, throughout the day, maybe sleep in the night, then they all say it's best to have your eyes open because the light comes in and helps you keep your mind sharp, which is a major point. If we have time, we'll talk about this. But for most of us, it makes us distracted because we don't have that much internal focus, you know. So if you can, fantastic, if you're used to that. Otherwise, have your eyes lightly closed. But have your eyes beneath your eyelids, looking down as if you're looking along your nose at the ground. Again, having your eyes up on your head makes you agitated. So this is the main points of the traditional sitting position that is found to be conducive to enable your mind to do the job of whatever it is in whichever meditation you're doing. Because your mind meditates, not your body. So now we'll just get ourselves focused for like 2 minutes, okay, 3 minutes. What we're going to do is, this is a typical mindfulness meditation, a typical concentration technique to get us started. And that is, you've got to focus on something, the mind. Okay, before we go too far, don't think, I am about to watch my breath. It's like holding the thing with your hand. Which part of I will watch my breath for a couple of moments? It'll be your mind. So then you have to ask, what part of my mind will be watching my breath? Be specific, you know. Well, the main part is called awareness, or it's attention. You know, we say, pay attention. Well, attention is one part of your mind. It's a particular concept. So this attention, imagine, is going to watch the sensation at the tip of your nose as the breath goes in and as the breath goes out. The attention will pay attention to that sensation for like 2 quality minutes. We'll do that first. So first, just to locate that sensation, take a couple of deep breaths all the way down to your abdomen, but not loud. The person next to you shouldn't hear you. All the way down, breathe all the way in, all the way out, and locate that sensation around your nostrils, okay? And because that's what we're going to focus on first for a couple of moments. Just do that. Okay, so we've located that sensation. So what we're going to do now is 2, maybe 3 minutes of concentrating. Sounds so easy. Technically, it is easy. The only reason it's not easy for us is because we're addicted to not concentrating. We're addicted to following every thought that arises and get completely scattered. And so in this particular first kind of meditation, this concentration meditation, I have to explain first, okay? There are 2 main obstacles. One is the tendency to go to sleep, or they call it dullness. Your mind becomes very dull. And the other problem is the mind gets overexcited. We go between these 2 extremes. And if you were doing just this meditation technique, and it can take years to accomplish single-pointed concentration, this is the 2 main obstacles that you're learning to counteract in order to keep your awareness or your attention focused on the object. So for this 2 minutes, it's just 2 minutes, but it'll be, you know, it's really intense. We're going to make this really strong promise to ourselves. I will not miss 1 moment of my breath. So almost think like you're walking on the edge of a cliff. You know very well, if you were walking on the edge of a cliff, there's no way in the universe you're going to lose attention. You're going to be absolutely, completely focused. So almost that sense of tension. One of the biggest mistakes we make is thinking that this type of meditation, the first 2 minutes we're going to do, concentration meditation, the biggest mistake we make is to think it's about relaxation. It has got nothing to do with relaxation. We need relaxation. So kindly lie down, please. It's a lot easier. This is not a relaxation technique. This is to develop a state of mind that we just don't develop because our minds are bone lazy, that would rather follow all our thoughts. So it's an incredibly difficult job to do. So you need to be very alert, very conscious, very determined, and watching like a hawk. So just a bit more to explain. There's many parts of your mind, like we've been talking, that all do the job to get me to watch my breath, the parts of your mind. So the part is attention that watches the breath. Then there's another part, and we don't recognize these parts because we're not trained. But there's another part, I remember the Dalai Lama calling it like a policeman. It's called vigilance or alertness. It's like watching every second. And the millisecond attention wanders off from the breath, and it definitely will. Vigilance brings it back to the breath. Just think this way, you know. We don't notice it. There's another part, of course, it's called mindfulness, which is the simple, bare-bones ability to not forget that you're watching your breath. That's what happens all the time. You wander off, and 10 minutes later, you wonder what you're doing because you're off thinking about yesterday or something. So there's many bits that all play the role to help this experience of watching your breath. So the main one is you just determine. We're going to determine now for 2 minutes. We'll do two quality minutes. I will watch my breath. And the second you wander off, you bring it back to the breath. You bring your attention back to the breath. You pick yourself up and you bring your attention back to the breath. Don't get mad at yourself, you know. Don't think you shouldn't be going off the breath. It's natural. So every time you wander off, bring yourself back to the breath. That's it, you know. For two quality minutes. Taking full, complete breaths, but not loud. With strong determination not to lose the plot. Maybe 3 minutes. Bring your attention back to the breath. Just the breath. Keep your mind very sharp, not spaced out. Just the breath. So now with this clear mind, we're going to do these four psychological steps, go through some, basically some thinking. You know, Tibetans, as we said, call this analytical meditation. It's a very grand term for thinking in a focused way, that's all. So, okay, the first step is, as we call, regret. Not guilt, but an intelligent recognition that I've done and said things that have harmed others based upon neuroses. And this is what leaves imprints in my mind that will ripen as my suffering. So I don't want suffering. It's very simple. This is the basis of regret, not guilt. I am sick of suffering. I am sick of suffering. So I regret. Let's say that we'll go through the seven of the body and speech, you know. I regret anything I've done with my body that has harmed sentient beings, the killing. You know, we've maybe killed humans, we've had an abortion, we've killed fish, we've killed creatures, ants, you know, lice, rats, cockroaches. So if you're not ready to say you regret it, don't. But think about it, listen to it. So if we do, if we think we're buying into, we're accepting the Buddhist teaching that, you know, that sentient beings don't want to suffer and that harming them based on delusions, either anger or attachment, will only harm us. And of course, from the depths of my heart, any killing I've done this life, and why not think since beginningless time, because I'm carrying around all those seeds in my bank vault of karmic seeds, nothing goes astray. I regret from the depths of my heart any harm I've done with my body to sentient beings, killing, especially that one, the most intense. But also the stealing, you know, you use your body based on attachment to take what is not given, based on attachment. That one too, totally. What I've done in this life, what I remember. We're just lazy sometimes, take things and don't return. These days with computers, it's much more tricky. Downloading movies, downloading music, it's so easy to take what is not given. We've really got to think about this one, you know. Because we're greedy, because we're mean, we'd rather not spend money. So we take, you know. So think about that one. Maybe you're not ready to regret that because it's giving you a panic attack to give it up. But think about it. Then the third one of the body, you know, is where we use our strong attachment energy to harm others. Raping, forcing ourselves on people, manipulating people to have sex, cheating on partners, taking someone else's partner. Look at the pain and suffering it causes, you know, driven by our craving, the way we harm others with our body in these three ways. Of course, there's other ways. You punch, you kick, you do all sorts of variations, but these are the three main ones, we could say. So thinking, I regret any of these actions I've done this life, today, yesterday, this life, based on delusions, since beginningless time, that have harmed sentient beings. I regret it particularly here because I do not want the seeds I've planted in my mind when I did these actions. I don't want them to ripen as my future suffering. This is the natural law of karma, Buddha says. So it's just common sense. It's like compassion for yourself. Like you regret smoking because you don't want the future result of suffering. I regret these crazy actions based on my delusions. Because I am sick to death of suffering. Even if we can't think of future lives of suffering, we certainly know we don't want to have people cheat on our partner. We don't want people to cheat on us. We don't want people to steal our things. We don't want to be killed or harmed. This is clear. So we regret for this reason, for our own sake, from the depths of my heart, anything I've done with my body's since beginningless time. So now our actions of speech, which is probably our main ones, we clever humans, you know, criticizing people behind their backs is one of our commonest practices. We criticize the politicians with joy because we're never going to meet them. We criticize our friends to other friends. We criticize our family to other people. We criticize our colleagues. We just don't even think it's a problem. We don't even see the harm we're doing to ourselves. Increasing our anger, increasing our resentment, increasing our jealousy, increasing our blame mode. We just don't even see what we're doing to ourselves. Because this is the point here. We're talking about doing actions that harm me. I'm sick of this suffering, so absolutely from the depths of my heart, I regret bad-mouthing people behind their backs. I know I can't stand that when I hear it's happening. So painful. Rabbiting on about nothing, which seems so innocuous. We just rabbit on about nothing, vomiting out our feelings. We don't care whether the person wants to listen. Uncontrolled. This is one of the major ones we do, just vomit out. It's completely depressing for other people. One of the karmic consequences of this is that no one pays any attention to what you say. Your words have zero value. This makes sense. We know that's so painful. So I regret all this uncontrolled rubbish, you know, because I don't want the future suffering. Harsh speech. We know at least we don't want people, you know, abusing us. We know it's awful. Well, karmic consequence of doing it is that it'll be done to you. One of the most basic laws of karma, Buddha says. At least this. So I regret abusive speech, harming others with my speech, because I don't want suffering. I'm sick of suffering. Lying. You know, saying things that aren't true. There's nothing more confusing than this. When people just blur out words and you know they're not true, you're so confused. Or when people don't believe your words. This is the result of not speaking clearly, truthfully. So all these actions we've done with our body and speech, surely, anytime, since beginning this time, I regret from the depths of my heart because I am sick of suffering. I don't want the karmic results of these. Because I produce my own reality. I produce my own suffering. I produce my future. Nobody else. Me. I do it. So I regret because I'm sick of suffering. It's like compassion for yourself. Finally, I'm going to give up cigarettes because I'm sick of harming myself. Like that. So now we look at the last three of this list, this little checklist of Buddhas of what's referred to as the 10 non-virtues. The last three are the three main delusions, and it's just like the beginnings of working on our mind here. So strongly regretting this craving, the bottomless pit. Like we'll talk about it in all terms, this attachment, the craving. For happiness, no, craving for food, for things of the senses, but the one, the deeper one we're talking about here, you know, the more advanced level to see, this constant neediness to be seen, approved of, loved, stroked, praised, this constant craving for comfort, this attachment that just runs the show, Buddha says, deeply from the depths of my heart, I regret this. Because I don't want more suffering. This is the basis of why I have anger, and anger is the basis of why I harm others. So this is the source, you know. And then I regret the grosser level of anger, which is this ill will, this terrible, painful resentment, this bitterness, this hurt, this offense, this unable to give up wanting others to suffer. So heavy if we have this. Anger bad enough that we explode and blame. But to hold on to it is like a nightmare. This, all of this, since beginning this time, I regret from the depths of my heart. Because it breaks my heart. It harms me. And I'm sick of suffering. Our ignorance, the root delusion. But here the grosser level of it, the way they talk about it is like this fundamentalist level of us. We're all fundamentalists, you know. I'm right, you're wrong. this deep ignorance, this deep-rooted, narrow-minded, small-mindedness that's closed to other people's views, that believes I'm right, believes that's wrong. So painful, so much fear. This deep ignorance that is rooted in the primordial ignorance. All of this, these three main delusions which inform the neurotic actions of body and speech, which are the ones that harm others, all of which are the ones that harm me now and in the future. So I regret from the depths of my heart because I am sick to death of suffering. So, like, if I have taken poison, whom could I turn to? Where's the doctor? That's the Buddha for us in this case. You know, our relationship is not like a creator. Nothing to do with creator. A doctor. A person who has medicine that I want to use because I do the healing. They recommend the medicine, I do the healing. It's me who purifies myself. So if you now imagine above our heads, if this suits, you know, if this works for you, if you don't want to do it, that's okay. We visualize Buddha enlightened energy in a particular form. It's like in this blissful, radiant form of the Bodhisattva. He's called Vajrasattva. Blissful white body, sitting on a lotus. In Indian style, you see those pictures, you know, around here. It's Vajrasattva. Radiant light. Everything's made of light, not substantial. Blissful face. Sweet, very sweet energy. And he's holding a bell in his left hand, which represents wisdom, and a Vajra, as they call it, in his right hand, which represents the other wing, compassion wing, method. And it represents emptiness, the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Sitting on a white lotus, radiant, blissful, in this kind of white silken clothes, the Bodhisattva style, you know. It's kind of like the Indian royal aspect, with beautifully decorated with this five-pointed crown on his head and jewelry, his ears, his upper arms, wrists, ankles, like you see in the pictures, in the statues. Above your crown, facing the same way as you, radiant light energy. Blissful, clear, wise, compassionate. In a sense, like a mirror image of our own potential, showing us what we can become. So if you have a spiritual teacher, a person in a human form whom you relate to, you know, who's the Buddha for you, this makes it more personal. You imagine it is their mind manifesting as Buddha Vajrasattva. For my benefit. Delighted to find a doctor who's got methods that I can use to heal myself, develop my marvelous potential. So now we now have compassion for others. First one is like compassion for yourself, regret. Here now it's compassion for those we have harmed first. Those we've killed. I mean, if it's countless lives, we've killed billions of beings, there's no question for the Buddha. So all the sentient beings I've harmed, killed, lied to, cheated on, stolen from, bad-mouthed, you know, gossiped to, lied to. Countless sentient beings. Think of somebody particular in this life that you know you want to have compassion for, whom you've harmed, people you've cheated on, people you've harmed, whatever way. Think of even just one or two. It's really good to make it personal. You know. And then, of course, all the others since beginningless time. Countless sentient beings. I regret for their sake now. Because I know what suffering's like. I know how unbearable it is to suffer at the hands of others. So that's their suffering. So I must, for their sake, purify myself, transform myself. For their sake, not just for mine, but for their sake. And now if you can, Think of those who've harmed you. This might be too hard for us, so don't do it if it is. But if you can. So why would we have compassion for them? Very simple. Because they will suffer in the future because of their harmful actions. So I must purify for all sentient beings' sake. So now the third step, we apply the remedy. So now imagine from Lama Vajrasattva's heart, he sends powerful, like a hose of energy, so intense, of this nectar, liquid energy, imagine, but very focused, and it kind of arcs around and enters through your crown and forcefully fills you. So we do three levels of purification. So first of all, we imagine this powerful, blissful, radiant nectar forcefully entering our crown, forcefully filling us, and then just naturally driving out all the imprints of all the harm we've ever done since beginningless time with our bodies. And this is forced out through all the lower parts of our body like filthy liquid and disappears into space, not one atom left. So only imagining this, thinking this, just imagining it, as we say the mantra of Vajrasattva three times. If you don't know, just listen and focus on the visualization, delighting in this, wanting to do this, having confidence in this. Every atom of negativity since beginningless time created by my body, forced out by this powerful nectar coming from Buddha Vajrasattva. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopatita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anurakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sarva Karma Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tatagata Vajra Mami Mutsa Vajra Bawa Maha Samaya Sattva Ahung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopatita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anurakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tatagata Vajra Mami Mutsa Vajra Bawa Maha Samaya Sattva Ahung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopatita Dido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anurakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsame Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tatagata Vajra Mami Mutsa Vajra Bawa Maha Samaya Sattva Ahung Pe. So delighted. Imagine now, full of this radiant nectar, not one atom left of all the imprints created left in my mind by my actions of body since beginningless time that have harmed others, disappeared into space, not one atom left. How marvelous. So now Lama Vajrasattva very happily this time sends the nectar from his heart that arcs around and forcefully enters our crown, but this time forces up to the top part of our body all the imprints since beginningless time of all the harm we've ever done to sentient beings with our speech. And it's forced up out through the top part of our body and disappears like filthy liquid into space. Just like as Lama Yeshe says, when you turn on a tap in the sink, all the junk in the glass comes to the surface, doesn't it? Just like this. Imagine all the imprints of all the harm we've ever done since beginningless time to sentient beings with our speech, forced out by this radiant nectar filling us. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Suto Kayo Mebawa Supo Kayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsa Me Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagawan Sarva Tata Gata Vajra Mami Mutsa Vajra Bawa Mahasamaya Sattva Ha Hung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Suto Kayo Mebawa Supo Kayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsa Me Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajra Mami Mutsa Vajra Bawa Mahasamaya Sattva Ha Hung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Suto Kayo Mebawa Supo Kayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsa Me Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajra Mami Mutsa Vajra Bawa Mahasamaya Sattva Ha Hung Pe. How marvelous. Every atom of negativity created by a rubbish speech disappeared, gone, full of this blissful nectar. So now we imagine from Lama Vajrasattva's heart, this time he sends beams of light. And I'm sure, I don't know if beams of light can arc around, but we imagine they do. So we visualize from his heart laser beams so powerful of white light that arc around and enter our crown and this time instantly fill us, instantaneously removing, annihilating all the imprints of all the delusions, starting with ego grasping that gives rise to this bottomless pit of attachment to get what the I wants, which gives rise to anger, the panic attack when it doesn't get what it wants, which gives rise to the jealousy and all the other dramas. All of this instantaneously gone. And this, the root source of our suffering and the root source of why we harm others. Instantly gone, annihilated by this radiant, blissful white light. Just as Lama Yeshe says, as soon as you turn the light on in the room, the darkness is instantly dispelled, isn't it? Like that. Imagine. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Suto Kayo Mebawa Supo Kayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsa Me Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajra Mame Mutsa Vajra Bawa Mahasamaya Sattva Ha Hung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Suto Kayo Mebawa Supo Kayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsa Me Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tadagata Vajra Mami Mutsa Vajra Bawa Mahasamaya Sattva Ha Hung Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Teno Patita Dido Mebawa Suto Kayo Mebawa Supo Kayo Mebawa Anorakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Memprayatsa Sawa Karma Sutsa Me Sitam Shriyam Kuruhung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajra Mame Mutsa Vajra Bawa Maha Samaya Sattva Ha Hung Pe. How wonderful. Think. Every atom of negativity in my mind gone like a dream, full of this blissful light. So now the fourth step, and as one lama, Bhabongka Rinpoche says, the most important. This one is why the fishermen, the tragedy of the sentient beings in this world as we see, who come into this life with the tendency to kill, rape, steal, torture, murder, without control, have such compassion because they haven't vowed to stop doing them, which is exactly why the other story I told you about my friend whose child, she was taking the lice out of his head. He's like three and he's crying with compassion for the lice. Mommy, mommy, don't hurt them. It's their home. Leave them alone. And he spent the last 40 years of his life never killing a living being. Why? Because he must have practiced in the past and vowed never to kill. And not only that, the bonus, but compassion is right there. And neither of those parents taught their children the fishing, the little boy, the tendency to kill that he hadn't purified by vowing not to kill again. And the little boy who had, clearly, we can deduce it. So this is the view of karma, you know, that we have to, and this is taken, of course, on board the view of continuity of consciousness from life to life. This is the view we're taking here, our hypothesis. And that we come into this life programmed with our own tendencies. So this is what we're doing here, programming our mind to never want to kill, never want to lie, never want to steal, never want to harm. How incredible. It's not just wishful thinking. It's programming your mind. It's molding your mind into that shape. That's what thoughts do. This is the meaning of karma. Your thoughts, your intention. It's not some mystical thing. It's not just crossing your fingers and hoping for the best. So, if we have taken vows, we've say, taken refuge, taken the five lay vows, then we will reiterate. We will say, I will never kill again. I will never lie again. Like that. But if we haven't, and we don't want to lie to ourselves, maybe we make some decisions now. Maybe we've never thought about doing this before. Maybe we'd like to think about it. Because we're the boss, remember? We go at our own pace. So those, you know, as Limache says, you don't lie to yourself. You make decisions according to your capacity. Let's say you've got a habit to be angry. You don't say, I'll never get angry again. That's nonsense. But you might say, I won't get angry for one day. I won't get angry for 1 week. I won't get angry for 5 minutes. You be sincere with yourself. In this practice, you're talking to yourself. You're becoming your own best friend. Not just saying some religious words for someone else's sake. You're being your own boss here, in charge of your own life. You make decisions, you know. This is so powerful. So you make decisions to yourself. Even a couple of your old rubbish habits, let's say you get paranoid easily, let's say you get jealous easily, let's say you lie easily, you steal easily, let's say you jump on people's partners easily, whatever you think your rubbish habits are, make some decisions. Even if you're going to say, I'll do the best to think about it, maybe you can even say that much. Talk to yourself. Be reasonable. If you've got vows, reiterate them. If you've got bodhisattva vows, tantric vows, whichever one, you be reasonable with yourself. Make firm decisions. So for a couple of minutes, make some decisions to yourself. You're talking to you, you know, nobody else. You are your best friend here. Don't think it's religion. Nothing to do with Buddha. He's happy for you. You do it. So think to yourself for a few minutes. Make some decisions. What you're going to do, what you're going to refrain from is the one, but also what you're going to do, you know, I will do my best, this, that. A few little things to help you. Talking mostly in relation to actions that harm others, but it can also be your delusions, you know? So think to yourself, first the actions that harm others, then the actions also that harm you, like stuffing in too much cake, and then also the states of mind, your main delusions. Give yourself a few minutes to think about it. And now we think, you know, if you have a relationship with the Buddha and this makes sense to you, and especially if you have a teacher, a lama, whom you see as the Buddha, then you kind of think they're like they're so delighted with you. And then you imagine this lotus that Buddha's sitting on dissolves into his body. And he dissolves into white light very blissfully. And the energy of the Buddha, you know, dissolves this white light energy, this blissful enlightened energy, comes through your crown, completely merges with you, fills you completely. And you think, the body, speech, and mind of the Buddha, the body, speech, and mind of my Lama, and my body, speech, mind, same thing. And then just imagine your consciousness, your energy, just no thoughts, just limitlessly vast, not just stuck in this little body. Expand, vast, limitless, blissful, clear, radiant, no thoughts. And now we think, you know, we finish thinking, you know, I'm going to walk out of this door with my body and my speech. And you think, my body and my speech, think like a bodhisattva. My body and my speech, what's the purpose? For the sake of others. My mind, that's my business. So watch my mind like a hawk every second to adjust what's there, to know I can change it, to not identify with the rubbish, to identify with the goodness, to see my mind ever more clearly. So tricky, ego, so tricky. And use my body and speech for others. Make this aspiration, you know, and think whoever sees me, hears me, talks to me, touches me, smells me, tastes me, may they benefit from my presence. This is like the essence of the two wings of the bird, wisdom and compassion. The wisdom wing is your mind, working on your mind, and the compassion is the body, is your body and speech. That whatever you do with your body and speech, necessarily for the benefit of others. This is when it's amazing. So the more you work on your mind, the more it informs your actions of body and speech. They become more and more marvelous, more and more beneficial for others. Think like this. And so we think this 2 days, as long as we've been here, every single thought we've had is as many seeds as we've planted. We might remember most of it. That's okay. They've gone in. They won't go astray. And so we think, may we nourish these seeds from the second forward with our efforts, our work, our practice, analyzing, thinking, going one step at a time at our own pace, so that these seeds do ripen no matter how long it takes in the development of my amazing, marvelous potential, limitless bliss, clarity, compassion, for my sake and the sake of every sentient being. So we just say there's 5 little aspirations together in the back of your notes, okay? If you'd like to, as our dedication prayer. I'm trying to find my text here. Won't be long. That's quicker, isn't it? Thank you. Okay, so these thoughts, maybe these if they make sense to you, have these thoughts go into our mind. When it says three times merits, all that means is all the virtuous actions from the past, present, and future. Right. As a result of the three times merits of myself and others, may bodhicitta, this marvelous aspiration, this marvelous, marvelous aspiration to be a benefit to others, based on compassion, from which happiness of all sentient beings comes, be generated in the minds of self and other sentient beings without delay, even for a second, and that which has been generated, may it increase. As a result of the three times merits of myself and others, may the realization of emptiness be generated in the minds of self and other sentient beings without delay, even for 1 second, and that which has been generated, may it increase. As a result of the three times merits of myself and others, may I, who am empty from my own side, achieve Guru Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, which is empty from its own side, and lead all sentient beings who are empty from their own side to that enlightenment which is empty from its own side as quickly as possible by myself alone. Whatever dedication the victorious one's gone to bliss of the three times have admired as best, I shall also perfectly dedicate in the same way all these roots of virtue so that I may perform good works. Because of the past, present, and future merit created by me and by the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and sentient beings, may I, my family, students, and all sentient beings be able to actualize completely in this very lifetime Lama Tsongkhapa's path of unified sutra and tantra, which is pure like refined gold. May this pure teaching of Lama Tsongkhapa spread in all directions and flourish forever. All right. Goodbye. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Well, that's maybe good. I don't know, sure. Energizing. Thank you. Okay. 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 All right. Thank you, dearest Mike. You're very kind. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you, Mike, for working so hard for the center. Thank you for all coming. Okay. But I've got to thank you for coming because this is why. This proves interdependence also. I like talking about this stuff because this is what I'm trying to do myself. So I would look very stupid talking to myself, wouldn't I? So thank you for allowing me to be a show-off and be like Ronnie Corbett and talk to you all. Okay? I'm really grateful. Thank you so much. Thank you, darlings. Someone come and talk to me and say goodbye and hello, isn't it? They're allowed to come?
No, they come and come. You really can. Yes. So please come up and offer Qatar and have a chat and the rest of it. But not too much because there's quite a lot of you. And otherwise, we could be here for tomorrow as well. So please, if you have if you'd like to make an offering, offer the scarf and say hello. Mazel tov. Okay.
Okay.
That.
I do.
Oh, yeah, all right. Oops. If anyone hasn't got a cutter, please come outside and grab one. There's plenty there.
Where are they?
In the front, just in that bay window.
Oh, okay.